I was taking piano lessons and was always kind of like scolded for not being studious enough with like learning to read music and stuff. Just wanted to sit at the piano and come up with little songs. And like, I would walk into the kitchen, my mom's like making breakfast and she's like whistling the song. And I'm like, oh my God, I made that. Like that didn't exist. And now like someone has it stuck in their head. Like that is so cool. And I was just recently doing a masterclass at a friend's high school here in Brooklyn that was about songwriting. And one of the students in the class happened to be a Lake Street Dive fan. She came up to me after class and she was like, I'm making a cover of Hypotheticals. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, that's totally okay. That's awesome. And I was like, can I hear it? And so I watched her like tracking on her GarageBand the vocals to Hypotheticals. And she just did it from top to bottom perfectly. Like she knew every nuance of like the vocal phrasing. Again, like I still have that feeling where I'm like, wow, someone like knows this and loves it. I just love music so much and songs so much. And so like being able to give that to someone else feels like magic.
That was Bridget Carney, and this is Sheeros, a podcast with a mission. To turn up the volume of women's voices in music across genres and generations, Sheeros is a deep dive into the experiences and perspectives of women and gender-expansive folks in a still overwhelmingly male-dominated music industry. It's a space where we discuss challenges and triumphs, how far we've come, and how far we still have to go. Telling our stories is the first step to making music better for everyone. I'm Carmel Holt. Bridget Carney is best known as one of the founding members of Lake Street Dive and is their bassist, vocalist, and one of the primary songwriters for the band. As an award-winning and prolific songwriter and an artist who's always been musically adventurous by nature, Bridget's also been releasing solo albums since 2007 and involved with numerous side projects. A quick tally on her Wikipedia page, I counted 16 albums among them, not including the 11, soon-to-be 12 albums she's recorded and written for with Lake Street Dive. Bridget, who's Iowa-born and Brooklyn-based, is also an in-demand collaborator, and she's written for, toured with, and recorded with a growing list of artists like Ed Sheeran, Margaret Glasby, Aoife O'Donovan, Rodney Crowell, and so many others. And somehow, she also finds time to teach instrumental and songwriting lessons, including a course at Princeton University. Bridget's third album under her own name just came out and is yet another fantastic showcase for her brilliant songcraft skills, musicianship, and emotional range. I'm so thrilled to welcome the multi-talented Bridget Carney as this week's Sheero in the Spotlight. Bridget Carney, welcome to Sheeros. Yay!
Thank you, Carmel. Woo!
I'm so happy to have you here solo. I think this is our first solo ride.
Yes, yes. Good to be back.
Congratulations on Comeback Kid. It's hard to define what number album this is for you outside of Lake Street Dive because you have all these various configurations of your solo work of what you do. So I'll let you guide us. Like, is it three? Would you call it album three for Bridget Carney?
I think so. I think this is my like third full-length solo album. And then in between, there's also been like stuff that I've put out as Bridget Carney and Benjamin Lazar Davis, and stuff that I've put out as B.B. Wisely, which is me, Ben, and Will Grafe.
Right. So first question, I think, is like, how do you determine what is a Bridget Carney solo work, whether in song or even in a body of work, and where it falls in all of your various projects and configurations?
Sure. I feel really grateful to have like these couple of different outlets for like, in particular, like different emotional zones, because then you don't have to like try to cram it all into one thing, you know?
Yeah.
I think having solo projects as one outlet and like what I do with Ben and Will as a second outlet has made me a better collaborator as a band member of Lake Street Dive. Because again, like I feel way psyched about like that just being a really true democracy and collaborative effort to see what we do together, you know? And then the other projects are like also collaborative in their own way. You know, it's called a solo record, but of course there are like many, many other people involved. And so, I mean, one of the great things about that is because you're a solo artist, you can make that cast of collaborators like different every time if you want. And if you discover that you're like really psyched about someone that you didn't know until last year, then you can just be like, you're my new collaborator, you know,
welcome in,
let's make something. So yeah, that part feels really exciting and fun and freeing. And then, yeah, getting back to the sort of like emotional core of things, like I think really sort of most songs could go in a lot of directions, but specifically the difference between like sending a song to Rachel to sing and sing it myself. I think Rachel has a sort of inherent power to her voice and her delivery, and she always sounds very strong. And my voice is like sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum. It sounds like very soft and vulnerable and weak, I guess, or something, you know?
No.
Well, but not weak as like not a bad thing, but just as like a quality. It sounds tender and vulnerable. Mm. And so like choosing which songs you want to have like those two qualities can really like change a song.
Yes.
Yeah. And also like there are things that I can write for Rachel to sing that I like simply couldn't pull off. Like I would say Good Kisser is a great example where I'm like, you sing that. But yeah, it ends up that like a lot of the songs that I put on my solo record are like ones that don't seem right for Lake Street Dive because I want them to be a little more vulnerable and inhabit like a different emotional space. And then the stuff that I do with Ben and Will feels like very kind of experimental musically. Like it's kind of the most out there that I get to be. And so there's a great joy to just like nerding out in that way and getting weird and experimental in that outlet.
My Gemini sister, we got to have all of the options available to us, right?
Exactly.
It's like there's just too many facets.
Yeah. And like, you know, your life is so rich with experiences and also eras, like different ways that you feel throughout the course of many, many years. And so expecting someone to like put the same sort of frame on all of these different things that you go through, I think is just too much to ask.
So cool that you've crafted this life for yourself where you have that kind of latitude. Let's put Comeback Kid in a timeline. Where did Comeback Kid happen?
So I started writing these songs, I guess, in the first couple of years of COVID. And I was doing some of these like song a day groups. I don't know if anyone else on your show or anyone else that you know have talked about these, but
yes,
it existed before the pandemic, but definitely became more popular during the pandemic because people had so much time and were looking for ways to stay inspired and be connected to each other. And so Alex and Cal from Rebel Bucket hosted a group that was like 7 days and you have to write one song each day. And you need to get it into them, email it to them by the time they wake up in the morning. Otherwise, you're kicked out. So it sounds extreme, but it's it's kind of like an accountability practice.
Yeah.
Like just it's so helpful as a songwriter to have deadlines and just like get things to the finish line, you know? So that was kind of where I first started writing songs for this record. And like the song Comeback Kid was maybe one of the earlier songs. And I immediately sort of latched on to that as like a possible album title. I think maybe partially as the sort of like reopening of the world, like after COVID, like, you know, we'd all been through this thing together and endured it and had come out on the other side. And then as that also just like related to kind of some things in my own life where like my first solo record is called Won't Let You Down, which is like very kind of like positive, upper, good spirits. And then the second solo record is called Snakes of Paradise. And it was definitely like coming from a place of like going through some shit, you know, and trying to get out the other side. And so Comeback Kid was kind of felt like, okay, we're back, you know, but, you know, the story continues as always. And you continue to have your ups and downs. And that's certainly present in this record too.
100%.
And yeah, that song Comeback Kid also is like partially about comeback in the context of like sports comeback, like heroic efforts to win the game. But it's also like comebacks in the meaning of like a punchline at the end of a a joke, that kind of comeback. So the famous Seinfeld episode where they say George is like regretting that he didn't come up with the right comeback. And he says, I should have said the jerk store called and they're running out of you. You know, so that's like quoted in the song. Yeah, which like we all do that too. We all like go through our memories and say, oh man, if I had had exactly the right thing to say in that moment, things would have turned out differently. And then finally the chorus is like, I'm the comeback kid. You know that I can't quit saying come back, come back, come back to me. So there's kind of that looking backwards and still feeling sort of like attached to the past.
Hail Mary, full of grace, when I drove 1,000 miles to watch you run away and hide. I'm sorry is all you can say.
That's Come Back Kid, and it wraps up the new album by the same name by Bridget Carney, and ironically was one of the first songs that you wrote, but you put it as a bookend for the album, which I kind of love. So at the point that you wrote this, I mean, it sounded so fully baked in terms of its concept. At what point did you know that you were making an album?
Definitely not on those first couple songs, but mm-hmm. I guess I like to be in the practice of just like making stuff as much as possible. And then at some point you say, oh, here's a nice batch of songs. I think this kind of makes sense together. And in the winter of 2021, I was making a record, producing a record for the band, the Brother Brothers. And they had just discovered that this was a good thing to be doing during the pandemic, is making records, because the shows weren't really happening. But so they got this amazing group of folks together. It was Phil Weinrobe, John Fadham. We were all living in a house together for a whole month and making that record. And at that time, I probably had 5 songs that I was happy with that I thought could be a batch. And I was like, wow, these guys are onto something. I should just be starting to make a record, and I should be like making the most of this time and sort of availability that people have right now. And so that was what made me think of Dan Millad as a producer. And he was somebody that I've known for probably 20 years, like since Boston days when he was at Berkeley and I was at NEC, but we never made anything together before. And I love his production and mixing. Specifically, I was really into this one song, Halo Light, that he recorded for Buck Meek. And that was one that was just like in my headphones on repeat for many months. And I was like, it's so cool the way that it's like, I find it to be like highly emotional, but also like super interesting and weird. Like the sounds are not, a lot of times you can't quite identify what's creating that sound, and but not at the expense of like any sort of emotion within the delivery of the song. So yeah, I reached out to him and we did the first 5 songs. And then I took another year or so to write more, and we did another 3 songs. And then another 6 months and wrote 2 more songs and finished it, which was kind of fun too, because then you can kind of listen to what you have and say, okay, I wish that we had a song that would do this for this moment in the record, or you can kind of write to the record.
Now, when you say that Dan produced, and by the way, for listeners who aren't familiar with Dan Millad, he also is a member of Lucius, and you have heard his production work on our theme song.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So when you say that he produced this, I mean, you also produce, and we talk about production a lot on this show because you don't often see women's names next to production credits. So I was curious about like what role Dan took, what roles you had, and how you feel about taking those kinds of credits for your work.
Yeah. So I was bringing into Dan for the most part, like pretty fleshed out demos. Like the demos would be multi-tracked with a guitar part, a drum part, a bass part, you know, all the layers of vocal harmonies and the song form. And in some cases, we would even use those sounds, like take things from the demos and use that as the final version. But I guess because of like the nature of like making a solo record, I was also very grateful to have a producer that was kind of like keeping me out of the deeper rabbit holes that you could go on you're like doing everything yourself. So I appreciated from Dan and also from the two engineers that worked on the record, Rob Shelton and John Joseph, that they were just like coming in a way towards the end of the process, because there's so many ideas that had already been worked on before getting to the studio that with fresh ears and fresh ideas. Once we got into the studio, I'm kind of in a state where I'm excited to see what somebody else thinks about it and what ideas they have. But we were mostly kind of like retracking the ideas that I put into the demos with like better, more interesting sounds, which again, I think is something Dan does like really well. And it was for the most part just me, Dan, and an engineer working on the process. So I would play a lot of the parts like guitar, keyboards. Dan was doing all the drums and percussion, and I was playing bass, which is my main instrument. But yeah, so that's a way that I like doing solo records. And that's kind of how I made my first two solo records too, is like me and a producer just doing layering all the stuff, with a few exceptions. There's a few guests on the record too. But yeah, there is a thing where I think culturally there are assumptions made about like women and what role they played in records. So as much as I wouldn't call myself a producer or an engineer on this record, like it might be worth going out of my way just for the sake of like changing those expectations to be like, yeah, I took the guitar solo, you know, like that's me. because again, yeah, there's just assumptions.
I forget who it was that I was talking to once that was talking about the default that they had. They were talking about how they made their record and who they collaborated with. All the people on the record and everyone who worked on it top to bottom, with the exception of them, were male. Mm-hmm. And when I was asking her about her choices and just kind of raising these questions, is that where you're more comfortable? Were you looking for other women to collaborate with and couldn't find them? And she was just like, you know, it's funny. I feel like I have actually sort of a default. It's actually not something that is conscious at all. And these are just the people that have always been around me. And I don't really think about it. But now that you're saying that, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I should think about that. So anyway, I just always love to bring this up because I'm curious how we shift it so that we can get more of a balance going.
Yeah, this is definitely, I mean, something that we think about a lot with Lake Street Dive, with like who our openers are. I mean, with kind of like I'm putting together various live versions of this record, which will be different bands in different places because it's not, you know, it's mostly just me and Dan playing things on the record.
So, totally.
So yeah, that's something I think about, is not to go with the default, like not to hire women just because they're women necessarily, but to like make sure they're on my list of people to call, you know. And in certain realms, it's really difficult. Like I would say, as you said, like specifically on the more like engineering producing, like there just aren't as many women to call. But, you know, hopefully this is something that we can like continue to open doors for future generations. And I know, and there's other stuff about like even in a earlier stage of, you know, high school, junior high, like there's
the IMA, the Institute for Musical
IMA.
Arts. Yeah.
Yeah, like making sure that young women have ways to get their hands on these things as early as possible to like find their passion for it and develop their talents, you know.
And confidence too.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I'll say, like, for me, I play the bass, which is like not a super common instrument for women to play. But I, like, my first three bass teachers were women. So I have them to thank for, like, making it seem like something that was something a woman could do, you know?
Totally. We have Bridget Carney with us. The new album is Comeback Kid. Let's pick another track. Your choice, dealer's choice. What would you like to play next?
Sure. Let's do Security Camera.
Ooh, I love this song. And I also really love the video. Talk to us about the song and also curious about the production sonic palette that you chose for the song.
Yeah. So this was a song. Sometimes the way that I like to write is just keeping a little notes app on my phone that's kind of ideas for songs, like thematic or lyrical ideas. But just even, I mean, the word security camera was probably what I had in my phone and nothing else, you know. But to me, what was interesting about that was like that there are these cameras around, especially in New York City where I live. You're always walking around and it'll be a sign that says like, you know, security cameras watching you, don't do anything bad. But they're also capturing you doing things that were good, you know, like they're sort of intended to catch people in the act of a crime, but they also capture like all these beautiful, amazing things that are happening all the time. And so the idea was like looking back to some of your most precious memories of like these perfect ephemeral moments that come and go. But then if you could go back to the security camera footage and just kind of like hold on to that moment forever, which, yeah, I think there's something sad about that and something hopeful about that, which is an interesting combination to me. Like there's definitely a backwards looking aspect to it, but I guess it's also kind of about like allowing yourself to love fully experiences that were temporary. So kind of in like, I guess you could even relate it to like the sort of emphasis on like marriage and relationships that last a lifetime and the sort of like hierarchy of that being like perceived as like the goal or the best. And it's like for some people it is. And in some instances, maybe you can have a totally wonderful relationship that's only a month long or however long it is, but you get to keep that in your security camera of your memory. And hopefully you can keep it in a way that can remain positive no matter what happened in the end.
Security camera, roll back the tape. I wanna see that day that he stole my heart. Security camera, make my day. And hit the playback on.
Security Camera from the new Bridget Carney album, Comeback Kid. Bridget's our guest today on She Rose, and I'm Carmel Holt. So for those that don't know a lot about you and your background, would you mind helping our listeners understand like how this all came to be, like your journey with music and how you ended up here today?
Yeah, so I grew up in Iowa City, Iowa, and I started playing the bass in the fourth grade, partially because the school orchestra started like the year before the school band. And so I was really excited about playing an instrument, and my choices were limited if I wanted to start right away. And so I was kind of thought to myself, well, I'll just play this one for a year and then switch to one of those cool shiny band instruments. But then by the time the year came around, I had started to enjoy the bass and also had a kind of family friend who was like a woman who was in high school that was playing the bass. And so she made it seem really cool to me. And there's a great teacher at the University of Iowa, Diana Gannett, who's an incredible classical bass player. So yeah, those people were around and making it seem cool to play the bass. And so I continued and was studying like classical music and jazz and also writing songs. Like in junior high, I had a rock band that I was playing electric bass in and writing songs for. But then in high school, I sort of got like diverted into this like jazz lane for a while where I was like, nothing is cool except for jazz. I only want to play acoustic bass and learn bebop heads on the upright bass. And so that is kind of what led me to go to New England Conservatory. And NEC was a really cool space. It was like relatively small, maybe 150 people in the jazz department at any given time. But their definition of jazz and improvisation was super wide. So there was all kinds of bands going on at that time. There was like a Balkan brass band that I played in, and there was like a Memphis ensemble and bluegrass. And the amazing thing about bass is that it kind of exists in like almost every style. And so I found myself in college just playing in like 15 different bands at a time, like so many different projects and all kinds of genres. And that was like so exciting and just like fulfilling to get to like be in all these different projects. And meanwhile, one of those projects was Lake Street Dive, which started at the end of my freshman year of college. Me, Rachel, Mike Calabrese, and McDuck formed that band and started writing songs for it, which we were calling it free country music. So it's like avant-garde country music, but we didn't really know how to do either of those things. So it, I don't know. It was whatever it was. It was very weird for 7 years or so. And but we got along. We liked hanging out together. And so we kind of found our way finally to like something that people liked and that we liked, actually. And so after college, moved to New York. And like still at that time, I think I was thinking of my path as maybe being a jazz bass player, like doing gigs around town and being excited about being part of the New York City jazz scene. And Lake Street Dive just kind of like slowly was growing and became a more important part of the way I thought of my life. And like, I think that was also around the time that I started getting really into songwriting and like kind of started to think of myself as more of a songwriter than a bass player. And so those are almost like two different identities that I, again, Gemini.
Yes.
Two different identities, like bass player, side person behind the scenes, you know, rhythm section player, and then like songwriter sometimes also in the background or now sometimes, you know, in the spotlight. Yeah. And Lake Street Jive kind of took off. So thankfully and miraculously, we're all still astounded at the fan base that we have these days. It's like totally incredible. And we still get along. We have a good time together. We have a good time making music together. So that's been my main job for the last 10 years or so. But we work maybe, we're shooting for 90 days per year on the road and then maybe studio time in addition to that. So there's still a lot of days in the year. And I think part of why I'm still like to have all these projects and wear different hats is like almost going back to those college days where like as the bass player, you were always jumping around into these different scenarios. And so I really like being able to do that. And musically, socially, just like lifestyle wise, it's so enriching to get to continually like be a part of music in like different ways.
Totally. And you also do like really cool, I don't know, you went to Ghana, right? Always seem to be traveling somewhere and doing musical projects that are also outside of your normal comfort zone. You want to talk to us a little bit about some of those travels and explorations that you've done?
Yeah. So in college, I did a semester abroad in Morocco, which was actually through Tufts University. Like I was going to New England Conservatory and Tufts double degree program. And so it wasn't like a music program. It was to learn Arabic and culture and history and stuff. But in Morocco, I found this community of Gnawa musicians that just like totally brought me into the fold. Like they would let me come over to their band practice every day after school. I would go there. And they would just be like sitting, passing this instrument called the Gimbri around in a circle and like teach me songs and brought me to these overnight healing ceremonies that they have because their music is part of a Sufi Islamic healing tradition. So they have these like overnight ceremonies in people's homes when someone is sick or hurt. And the band will come over and play from like 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., like all night. And there will be like incense and tea and people experience it spiritually and go into like trances and just kind of let the music like move them in this healing way. So that was one of my like first experiences of getting to be a part of like music abroad, and it was so wonderful and expanding. And musically too, their stuff is like, a lot of what's interesting about it is there's this like rhythm that, you know, we kind of think of things either as duple, duck, straight, or swung, like duck. And a lot of their rhythms are like in between those two things. And so that was just like breaking open a whole world to me that like, oh, I thought there was only these two things. And there's actually like a spectrum all the way in between those two things. So like getting to play music in different parts of the world, you realize time and time again, like, oh, I thought there were these rules and they're not actually rules, you know? And then you also like make all these friends and get to just see what other aspects of life are like in other parts of the world. So yeah, ever since then, I've been really in love with getting to do that. And Ben Davis and I had both studied some Ghanaian rhythms in college with a teacher of ours who had spent some time in Ghana. And so we, at some point, had the dream that we wanted to just go there and find some people to study with and like experience the music there. And so we went for like a month in maybe 2010 and learned all this amazing music and made an EP there with someone who we met who had a studio there. And then we went back again like 5 years later and made a whole record that we like wrote with these Ghanaian musicians that we met there and recorded there. Yeah, so that's kind of an ongoing thing that I hope to do again sometime, is get back there and get to collaborate with Steve Otambire and Aaron Bebe and the other musicians that we've met there. And then recently I was in Brazil for the first time. My friend Jeremy Gustin was down there playing drums, and we had our band maternity leave for Rachel's baby, Jupiter. And Jeremy is like, yeah, I have this gig in Rio. Like, it's 3 months and I'm living in an apartment in Rio and flying out to different parts of Brazil every weekend for 3 months. And I was like, that sounds like a good life. That sounds like a good setup. And so I made a plan to just come down and visit and hang and see some of the shows. And then weirdly, the bass player in the trio got his hand closed in a door like a week before I was going. And Jeremy's like, do you want to play some bass with us, actually? And so, yeah, unexpectedly was just like thrown onto these like pretty big stages in Brazil, like 2,000-3,000 people. This guy, Thiago York, is the artist that Jeremy was touring with, and got to jump on and play some bass with them. And again, yeah, it's just, it's crazy like how music connects you to people that you don't speak the same language and wouldn't otherwise get to like really connect with.
So amazing. Right. And I knew that there was a recent thing that you did and I couldn't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. It was that trip to Brazil. I remember you showing me some of the video. just like, oh, wild.
It was so incredible.
Wild. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I'm like super into a couple different Brazilian records and yeah, learning a lot from that music.
Okay, because we're doing Shiro's, I got to ask, like, you've just sort of traced this, what are we talking now, over a span of...
Well, Lake Street Dive is just coming up on 20. Our 20-year anniversary. Okay. That was our freshman year we started.
Okay, so what was your experience like in school? Were you outnumbered in the jazz program? When you were traveling, did you notice any differences about gender roles in music? Like, it's so great to be able to hear perspectives that are not just here in the States too.
Right. Yeah, definitely have been outnumbered in a lot of settings from growing up and playing especially jazz music. Like, I remember being in some kind of regional honors jazz band and there was like 22 people and just the one woman, you know? So that's something I've kind of like gotten used to some degree. And abroad too, yeah, not too many. I can't think of any female musicians that I met in Ghana or in Morocco. I remember there was one event that I went to, one of these overnight healing ceremonies, but it was actually 3 days long. It was kind of like a festival. Mm. And there was one event that was like just for women. And so that was all women watching and all women playing too. And that was the first time that I had seen a woman playing the Gimbri. But I will say, like, in spite of the lack of seeing many women musicians in that place. Like, I didn't find any walls to me playing. And in fact, like, people were always, I think, kind of like surprised by it. And like, there was a certain novelty to it. And especially because I already played the bass, like, I was able to pick up this instrument relatively quickly. And so I think that was, yeah, maybe almost an advantage or like an edge in some ways. I think, yeah, when expectations are low, then you can surprise people. And yeah, comparatively, like in the States, I am lucky to know so many incredible female musicians and doing all sorts of things, engineering, producing, playing, ripping guitar solos, like, yeah, just doing everything.
What did you play on this album besides bass? And was there anything new that you tried out on this album instrumentally, or any places that you feel like, wow, I pushed my edges this time?
Yeah, I played bass. I played electric guitar, acoustic guitar, piano, maybe some of my most involved piano playing so far, and synthesizers. There's a lot of synthesizers on this record. And I came into the possession of some synthesizers early in the pandemic because of my friend Robin McMillan got kind of displaced and left a bunch of musical gear in my basement. And so that was like a lot of what I was writing out the record on was these like synthesizers that I'd found myself in possession of by accident. That was kind of a new sound for this record. And one of my guitar solos from my demo like ended up on the record, which I was like really psyched about because, you know, it was just like a moment of inspiration again in my basement in my little solo rabbit hole. And then Dan was like, kind of like that guitar solo, we should keep it, you know.
Amazing.
Yes.
Do you want to pick either a song that makes use of the synthesizers where you're like, okay, like this is an example of what you're talking about, or the song with the guitar solo in it?
Yeah, like, well, If You're Driving, track one would be like one of the ones where the Yamaha DX7 sound is like right up the top, big part of the song. And then I Feel So Bad For You is the one with the guitar solo.
I love If You're Driving. Very like retro. Should we play If You're Driving?
Sure.
Anything you want to tell us about this song and also why you chose it as the opener to the album?
There was something I just really love about the feeling of this track. That's kind of a ineffable thing about songs. I feel like I can more successfully like analyze and craft on like lyrics or chords or something, but there's just the feeling of a track like this one is it's got this kind of like pulsating like forward motion, but in a very gentle way, you know, everything's like gently moving forward. Yeah. And this was also from one of those early Song a Day sessions and was thinking about the idea of like getting out of New York City possibly during that time. But there's an element of like also, you know, if you're in love with someone, then you would go anywhere with them. So the chorus is like, if you're driving, I want to go. Like, I don't care where it is. Let's get the fuck out of New York City and just enjoy each other's company.
You pulled up in your 76. You said, baby, you want to go for a trip. Well, let's go. Cause I've been idling out for a while with nobody to help me count the miles. I go slow. So pick me up on your way out of town. I don't care where we end up as long as you're around. If you're driving, baby, I wanna go.
That's If You're Driving. It kicks off the new Bridget Carney album, Comeback Kid, her third solo outing. And she's our guest today on Shiro's. I'm Carmel Holt. I want to just say that I love your songwriting so much. And I just want the world to know what a genius songwriter you are. And like any one of these songs could be like a mega pop hit too. Your pop sensibility while maintaining like emotional authenticity, I feel like that's your secret sauce.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I love pop music. And I also love being able to be a part of all my projects kind of from the ground floor. So like, you know, writing for Lake Street Dive and being in Lake Street Dive and writing for me and making my records, like, I think that's a priority to me in a way where like, I don't know if I would be happy like being a full-on songwriter for hire, you know, which is maybe like limiting in some ways, but you got to do what feels true to you, you know? And I think that's the most full version of musical satisfaction to me is like being able to be involved from start to finish on a project.
And I loved how you described having those two identities as the side person and the instrumentalist and kind of being in the background and then being a songwriter and being in the foreground and how it kind of scratches both of those itches. You know, we talked a little bit about your journey developing as a musician and as an instrumentalist. And so I wanted to take a moment to really like pay attention to that side of you. When you had that moment where you're like, actually, I really want to lean more into being a songwriter, what is it about writing songs that drew you in that direction that you still feel very called to?
Yeah, well, I can remember like the very first time that I wrote a song, which was like pretty young. I was maybe like 6 or 7, but I was taking piano lessons and was always kind of like scolded for not being studious enough with like learning to read music and stuff. But I was always just wanted to sit at the piano and come up with little songs. My first song went doom, 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 ba-doom, ba-doom, and walking along in the forest singing a song. With the chorus, doom, 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 doom. You know, it's, but I still remember that song and like just, I would sit down and play it and my family would like know it. And then you'd be like, walk into the kitchen, my mom's like making breakfast and she's like whistling the song. And I'm like, oh my God, I made that. Like that didn't exist. And now like someone has it stuck in their head. Like that is so cool. And I was just, recently doing a masterclass at a friend's high school here in Brooklyn that was about songwriting. And one of the students in the class happened to be like a Lake Street Dive fan before knowing that I was going to be the guest. And she came up to me after class and she was like, I'm making a cover of Hypotheticals. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, that's totally okay. That's awesome. And I was like, can I hear it? And so I watched her like tracking on her garage band the vocals to Hypotheticals, and she just did it from top to bottom perfectly. Like she knew every nuance of like the vocal phrasing. And again, like I still have that feeling where I'm like, wow, someone like knows this and loves it, you know. And that's the other thing too, is like I just love music so much and songs so much, and so like being able to like give that to someone else feels like magic and unbelievable.
Oh my God. And you're going to get to feel that on such a huge scale when you play Madison Square Garden. I'm like scared for you. I can't, like, oh my God. I mean, you're totally going to crush it. It's going to be great. What's the feels on that?
Oh, I can't even believe it. I won't believe it until it's the next day, you know? And like, excited, nervous, shocked, but also I feel confident about it because Lake Street Dive is like, we've been together for 20 years and I just have so much trust in like my bandmates and in our crew and in our fans too. Like I know that people are like going to be really psyched for us in that moment and happy to be there. So that's just a very different version of satisfaction or joy from music is like there's one version that's like newness and freshness, and there's this other side of like what we have with Lake Street Dive being sort of like stability and like long-term, you know, understanding. So yeah, this will be like a huge moment for us, but also I feel like it'll be like totally normal in a way. It'll just be like us doing a show like we always do.
I think so, too. I think you're going to manage to make it feel like you could be doing it in a small little theater. When you make a record like this, do you send it to any of your Lake Street Dive bandmates to get their vibes on it?
Sometimes. With this one, I haven't yet. I don't know. I like there's a few people that I send my records to deliberately with the question of sequencing, song sequencing. In that phase, there's like a couple of friends, Villery I send it to, and John Fadham. And yeah, there's just a few like valued people that I bounce things off of. But for the most part, I like saving the record till it's like out for everyone. So there's just kind of like more excitement for that moment.
Even though you've released so many records already in all of the various forms, like, does it ever stop being, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. What does it feel like for you? How's that evolved over the years?
Well, it's definitely still really, really exciting to like have this little secret thing that you've been working on, and then you get to finally let the secret out. And for this record, Comeback Kid, like, it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago that I put out my first solo record. And then there was a relatively long gap, but I was kind of working on Comeback Kid at the same time as I was finishing Snakes of Paradise. And so there was a lot of my thoughts and just work that was going into like writing and making those records. And then at some point I was like, oh, people don't even know that I'm spending all this time on this stuff. Like, it was almost like, again, like a secret. And I was like, I should start like telling people that I'm making all this stuff. And so, yeah, that was when like last year I was like, oh, I'm almost finished with Comeback Kid. I better put out Snakes in Paradise. And so we just kind of like dropped that one without too much fanfare, but just wanted to like get it out there finally. And then that has been left a little room for like with this rollout being more like, okay, now we're going to put this song out, get a little love to that, put this song out, get a little love to that. Yeah, so I'm super excited about the release. And there's also kind of an interesting, like, to use a Iowan metaphor, crop rotation of the way that I'm spending my time, where like last year felt a lot like being in the creative zone and being in the studio, writing, recording, making stuff. And this year feels comparatively much more about just like sharing that stuff and putting it out. And so I feel very like relaxed this year because I've kind of already put in the work, and now I just get to like enjoy it and share it. And then I'm sure by the end of the year, I'll look forward to like going back into a hole and making stuff again.
What do you do to recharge your creative batteries?
Well, I go to a lot of shows. I love seeing shows. And in New York City, there's a ton of that. And, you know, like movies and books and just any kind of like storytelling medium is inspiring to me. Like specifically, sometimes I need to really force myself to, because I'm also like incurably social. So I need to like put boundaries on myself to write songs. So actually, when I ran into you in Kingston at the Barbie movie, that was what I was doing, was like getting myself out of New York City, going to house sit for a friend and like writing songs for the new Lake Street Dive album. And I was like, I'm going to go to Kingston for 10 days. I'm not going to tell anyone I'm there, but I'm going to go to the movies as a little reward to myself and go to the movies every night.
and then I blew up your plan for
Right. And then secret. Who has bought the seat next to me? Carmel.
That was hilarious and the best surprise ever.
So fun.
I was curious about your teaching because you also just mentioned the masterclass thing. Does that give you creative fuel? I saw something that you've been doing, some classes at Princeton, right?
Yeah.
And like what that experience has been like.
This is my fourth year of teaching this class called How to Write a Song at Princeton. Mm-hmm. And it is so inspiring, like in many, many different ways. One way is like just the act of teaching itself, which like you're saying, like it's kind of forced me to like analyze what I am doing when I'm writing songs and like break it down. Like we'll spend 1 week focusing on melody and just like construction of melody and how you can make that really speak in different parts of your song. And then another week talking about groove. And so then I go to sit down and write a song and I'm like, whoa, like I really haven't like cared about the melody on this song yet. Like, I should do that. I should pay attention to that and do the things that I'm telling the students to do, you know? So there's like that version. The students' output is really inspiring to me because they are like not music majors. They're generally beginners and taking all these other classes, working really hard on their other subjects, but they bring in a song every week. And it's always like interesting in its own way. And like usually has some like really true like emotional resonance and cool musical ideas. Yeah. And then also every semester we get to bring in guests. And so I get to like just invite some of my favorite songwriters to come in and listen to them talk about songwriting, which is like so fascinating.
Who because have you brought everyone, in?
Well, the first year we had Sir Paul McCartney. that was like, it was on Zoom because it was COVID, so we weren't in person, but he came and listened to 3 hours of beginner songwriters. He had his little notebook out. He was making notes and he was so good at teaching, like, and talking about songs. He was also like super humble. Like he was like, you know, there's no right or wrong answer, but I'm just approaching this as if I'm your co-writer. So if we were writing the song together, you and I, 19-year-old Princeton beginning songwriter, this is what I would say, you know? Yeah. So he was amazing. Robin Pecknold from Fleet Foxes has come in. It was super interesting to hear about his process, which is like very different than mine. It's much more about like writing little fragments of musical ideas, like a bunch of them, and then deciding which ones make a good album together, and then deciding what the album should be about, and then writing all the lyrics and finishing all the songs, which is like so crazy. Yeah. Aruj Aftab came last year. So cool, like so inspiring. She came towards the end of the semester, and like sometimes we'll be talking about like, okay, you know, you got to keep everybody engaged, like, don't bore us, get to the chorus or whatever. And then Aruj comes in and plays this like 14-minute long, unbelievable like odyssey of a song that's like so moving. And yeah, so she was great. Maggie Rogers came, Cautious Clay. It's like such a joy to, yeah, get to have that be part of the gig, is like bring these people in and get to hear what they have to say about songwriting.
Oh my God, Bridget Carney, I want your life.
It's pretty great.
It's been so fun to hang out with you. Before we wrap it up, let's do the Shiro's Magic Wand, where I give you the Shiro's Magic Wand. And I say, with this wand, you could change anything in the music business and music spaces for women, non-binary people, queer folks. First wave of the wand, what would you change?
Whoa. Oh my goodness. Oh boy. I guess I would maybe change those, what we were talking about earlier, as default settings. Change the assumptions that are made about who is capable of what and who must have written the song or who must have been the guitar player. Or, you know, I wish I could just maybe shine a spotlight on the reality of what people are already doing and the reality of what people are capable of.
I love it. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Take us out. Pick a song to take us out with today.
Okay, let's play Obsessed.
I love this song so much, and the video is awesome.
Thank you.
I love it. It's like a little, both of the videos, Security Camera and Obsessed, are like little mini movies.
Yeah, like this is my new thing. I'm really into making videos right now, which I always thought of before as kind of like a chore or an afterthought to the song. But now I'm like interested in the layers of meaning that you can add on a visual level, and getting super into that.
So talk to us about Obsessed and maybe tease out the video for those that haven't seen it.
Sure. So Obsessed, I think the song is a pretty genuine just love song. It's kind of about like the magic in the first phase of falling in love with someone, where like it comes out of nowhere and surprises you. And the chorus just says, how did I get so obsessed with you? Like, how did this happen? What's happening to me? Why is my head up in the clouds? Why am I sweating? Why is my heart beating so fast? Like, this is crazy what my body's doing just because I met this person, you know? But the song was coming out around Valentine's Day, and so I just had this idea that it would be fun to put a sort of like twist on that. And so originally I was thinking of it as a horror romantic comedy, like within the span of the song, which is about 4 minutes long, I wanted it to go from like, oh my God, it's so adorable, these people are falling in love, how did I get so obsessed with you? And then by the end, it would be this like much, much darker version of obsession where I was imagining a lot of like fake blood. And but the thing is, I've never watched a horror movie. I'm too scared of them. So so I was, yeah, incapable of executing that idea quite. So we went for more of a stalker romantic comedy. And yeah, you see these two people meet on the train and go on a date and, you know, kiss. And then eventually by the end of the song, the how did I get so obsessed with you is like her standing creepily outside of his window while he's like reading at night. And then I'm there playing the bass too, which like the upright bass is to me just kind of a fun like visual gag. Like it's so big and ridiculous. So that was adding a level of sort of absurdity to the thing where it's like not only is she out there obsessed with him, but there's this like bass player there with her too.
Yeah, just one day. Storming, you couldn't stay too late. You had to work in the morning. Nice conversation, but we went our separate ways and thought maybe that was it. And I was newly on my own and finally okay with that. Not afraid to be alone, not looking for a way back. When you called me from vacation, I felt that same old way.
Bridget Carney, always so fun to hang out with you. Thank you so much for coming back to Shiro's and congratulations on Comeback Kid.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for Shiro's. Thanks for being you. You're the best.
You're the best. Many thanks to Bridget Carney for being with us. Her new album, Comeback Kid, is out now on Keeled Scales. Shiro's is produced by me, is mixed and mastered by Kelly Drake. Our original theme music is by Lucius. Shiro's is also a nationally syndicated radio show. You can visit shirosradio.com to find out more and support our work with Patreon or merch from the Shiro's shop. Keep in touch on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Carmel Holt, or find us at Shiro's Radio. And please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps us grow and bring you more Shiro's. Until next time, remember, music is our superpower. I'm Carmel Holt. Thanks for listening.